You're listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast, Asheville's premier soccer podcast. Guys, welcome back to another episode of You're Smarter Than Us. You know, we don't often do advertisements on this podcast, but you know, I had a company who, upon hearing who our guest was for this episode, reached out and wanted to do some advertisements specifically connected to our guest. So I thought I'd go ahead and ingratiate ourselves with Morton's iodized salt. Free your guests as well as your family from the annoyance of choked salt cellars by changing to Morton's salt. This unusual salt never cakes or lumps, but pours instantly rain or shine. Guys, welcome Jim Hicks from the 423 Soccer Pod over in Chattanooga. How are you, Jim?
Oh, Tim, I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you for getting Morton's to pay us to bring you on to the podcast. Guys, this is going to be a salty episode. If you have any slugs or margaritas around, move the slugs, bring the margaritas closer. It's going to be salty. So, Jim, I'm catching you on, I'm not going to lie, based on the way that Chattanooga FC had been running their fall NISA season, after losing to Michigan Stars last week, I kind of assumed that you guys were going to lose to Detroit City, and I was kind of excited to get the frustrated, you know, Jim that we're used to on social media, and here you guys go out and beat Detroit City away 2-0. Congratulations.
Right. Yeah. I really didn't do anything. Just sat and watched the last 30 minutes from behind my hands, and you know, with the sound off, because I just didn't want to listen to the Detroit announcers anymore. So, yeah, I mean, I was hoping for a draw. I really was worried because of the performance, but like I said to the guys from DCFCFC, and I think said something kind of like it to protagonists, but I talked to them, you know, I expected the guys to go up there and be professional. I expected them to go up there and fight. I expected them to go up there and represent the crest and represent the city. And that's exactly what they did. And they did it from the moment, the first whistle all the way to the end. I mean, this is a performance that I think the club had to have. And they went up there and did it. And, you know, I couldn't be happier about it.
So for those of you who may or may not know, Chattanooga is now Chattanooga FC, Asheville City's former NPSL Southeast compatriot, you know, in a weird way, our big brother in the NPSL, the club that helped us kind of cast our original form back in 2017 for the first season. And obviously, you know, I kind of proudly wear the cross of us being Asheville City, I mean, being Chattanooga's last victory in the NPSL proper. I just think there's a nice circular snake eating its own tail almost of that. But they are now officially a pro club. They're sanctioned. They're in NISA. NISA continues to move forward with their season. It's a very wonky season because of the pandemic. Of course, they only had so many clubs, and then the pandemic kind of put pressure on them. A few of them dropped out, whether it be because of finances or just disorganizations. I'm looking at you, Philadelphia, Atlanta. But Stumptown dropped out. Some of the Western teams dropped out, such as San Diego. And so whether it be to meet PLS standards or league standards to continue to exist as a league. Remember, NISA is a third division men's outdoor league. What they've done is they've split seven teams into two sides, the three California teams, and then the four kind of sturdy eastern sides. So it's Chattanooga, Michigan Stars, Cosmos, and Detroit City. Stumptown is taking the fall off. They are doing basically kind of like a round robin, but not home and away, just everybody's playing each other, and then they're going to meet for a single location, probably over the course of a weekend, because it will just be a semis and then a final tournament to crown a Eastern Division champion for the fall. Now, remember, again, what NISA is doing as a league, which is going to be very different than what USL is doing, is they are actually using that kind of Liga MX or NASL model of a fall season, crowning a champion, taking a winter break, and then coming back in the spring, crowning a champion, and then those teams kind of facing each other in a season championship. It's very novel. I kind of like it. It just is something a little bit different if you're going to differentiate yourself. Jim and I were talking off mic right before we started recording, and we realized that we spoke back in August last year, kind of at the end of the NPSL season, as Chattanooga was moving into what eventually became the Members' Cup, the former Founders' Cup, NPSL Pro, RIP. And then we spoke again in, I think, November, as they officially announced that they're going to go NISA and what that was going to mean as a league. So I think this is kind of nice at the tail end of, well, I say tail end, European soccer, NWSL, MLS, just all kind of wrapped up their project restart, bubble tournament sort of things. And now they're kind of reassessing for the fall, but they certainly aren't going to start seasons anew. USL, both League One and Championship, are kind of pitching forward with some sort of bastardization of their seasons. And I'm sure we'll touch base on that. This is all NISA is going to do these little tournaments, and then they'll probably again reassess. But NISA has not been silent. They have, right before this season started, they actually did something called the Independent Cup, which we'll touch on. And then we're going to kind of speak on what's coming up in the spring and a few of the expansion clubs and what may be coming back. So, Jim, just to start us off, you're a fan of a pro. Well, you're an owner of a pro team now.
Two pro teams.
Well, two, of course. And after tonight, you guys really own them. But how has this happened the way that you thought it was going to? Does pro feel the way that you thought it was going to?
I don't know. I didn't really expect pro to feel much different than I kind of hoped that it wouldn't feel much different than the CFCI have known for the past 10 years. Let me
frame that a little bit better. You're not playing, thank goodness, you're not playing Atlanta SC. You're not playing Asheville. You actually did just play Georgia Revs, and we'll touch on that in a minute. But you're theoretically playing the Cosmos. You're playing Detroit City, not in a friendly, in games that matter. Does being pro, being traveling not just regionally but kind of nationally, that does it feel like you thought it would?
Yeah, I think so. Going back to our first match, I mean, it was really cool to see the guys go out and play in Oakland and play a team that I think a lot of people are excited about, to play a club that really, I think, exemplifies what we think clubs should be on the West Coast. It was really neat to see them play out there. We talked to their kind of play-by-play announcer the week before the match, just to get a sense. And it was just different talking to, some guy who makes a career out of play-by-play, and he covers a team you're getting ready to play. Before we would talk to fans of the other team or maybe an owner of the other team or, something like that. But, talking to media that cover a professional team and a professional team that your club's getting ready to play, it does feel different. I think the way that CFC approaches the game feels different than we did, than how it was in the NPSL. So from that standpoint, yeah, it feels a little different to be pro. We're worrying about different things. We're actually worrying about and complaining about the fact that we lost a left back to the USL Championship, and that we have a we did a transfer, Tim. I mean, we have transfer fees. I mean, you know, what the heck is that? You know, you have to worry about the transfer market. That's only something I used to bitch about because I was an Arsenal fan. So now I get to bitch about it on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, I couldn't be more thrilled to bitch about it and be disappointed. That's my aesthetic on Twitter. So, you know, I love it. But it's still CFC. I still go, well, I haven't been to the stadium to watch a pro match yet. So, you know, but when I go, I'll see the same people that were there mm-hmm. in 2010 and 2011, you know, all the way up till, you know, to the rainy nights in Members Cup. So it's neat. It is really cool. And I do one correction. I think you forgot New Amsterdam when you talked about the East Coast. We have five in the East and three in the West for a total of eight. And I don't know, I've heard, I still don't know this, that all the teams are making this tournament. I've heard it two ways. I've heard it what you just described as a semifinal and a final. And then I heard that it may be all teams. So in some ways, Tim, it's just like we never left the NPSL because we don't know what the playoffs are going to be until maybe a week before the playoffs happen. So in that way, I feel right at home.
That's so NPSL. So kind of building off of that, we're looking at clubs that I think across the board, the ones that are participating in this tournament. And I'm just going to kind of shuttle off the West Coast. If I've learned nothing else from my USL friends, it's that East Coast fans just don't even pay attention to the West Coast, basically. You pay attention to like Phoenix when they have Dollar Beer Night, and you hear the Sacramento going, you know, MLS rumors. But other than that, you don't really pay attention. So I'm going to kind of do the same thing and just assume that Oakland's going to, you know, do extremely well and kind of run that. Maybe Cal Strikers, definitely not LA Force. But yeah, I'm going to stick to the East Coast because I think what's happening on the East Coast is more interesting. Now, caveat, I think for NISA to be taken more seriously, they've got to figure out the West Coast. But that's a conversation for another day. So let's stick on the East Coast. We're running through this tournament, and almost every team in this tournament that's currently existing has something that I think is interesting to talk about. And again, I want to frame this as a conversation of what Chattanooga is competing in is the same thing as USL League One. It's an outdoor Division III men's league. So what Chattanooga is doing independently is comparable and basically on the same level as what the Greenville Triumph are doing, is what Tormenta are doing. These are teams that I think most Asheville fans have some connection to and some touchstone to. I you know, Cameron Saul played for the Greenville Triumph. One of our, you know, star players the first year we existed, Elma N4, is currently playing for Omaha. So that's what this is. But NISA is independent. It is not under the USL umbrella. NISA's big sales pitch is there's no expansion fee. Currently, a USL League One expansion fee, I think, is $2 million. Last year, it was $1 million. This is kind of USL's business model. They expand, they bump up the expansion fees. This is no different than MLS. It's no different than the NHL. You know, NHL just sold their last expansion spot to Seattle, the Seattle Kraken. Great branding, by the way, for I think $650 million. My jaw dropped when I saw that. I was actually trying to pull that number to figure out what it was compared to what Charlotte FC paid, and I couldn't believe it was twice. But nonetheless, This is what League One is currently doing. You know, they're expanding, they're paying this. So NISA's gimmick, NISA's sales pitch, whether, and I have issues with it, but their sales pitch is they have no expansion fee. Their league cost, their league fees every year is more, much more, substantially more. And they have a decentralized office, which basically means that the company that owns NISA owns about 40%. They run it as the centralized office, and the individual clubs collectively own 60% of the league. So the clubs themselves could theoretically override decisions made by the central office, which it only owns 40%. So Chattanooga, Detroit, Cosmos, these are kind of names that I think most lower league fans would know. And, you know, oh, yes, I, you know, NPSL or, you know, this or that. But we have some new blood, I guess you could say, in the mix here. And I again, there's five in the East, and I think we'll touch on each one because I do continue to maintain that I think NISA is a viable option, theoretically, for Asheville City in the future. If you know, nothing in the lower leagues stays static, everything's fluid, nothing looks in 2010 like it does in 2020. Well, nothing looks in 2020 like anything. Yeah, but really, what will exist in 2030 is not what exists now. So I think all knowing what all your options are and exploring them is just, again, maintaining your knowledge of what's out there. So this is why we constantly talk about NISA. But Jim, you know, Chattanooga, they sold some fan shares. I actually just heard that there was a owners meeting recently.
Yeah, there was.
Owners meeting. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that and what was discussed in that meeting?
Sure. I mean, it's, you know, it's it was nice. It was virtual, so we had to do it via Zoom. You know, so that part of it was kind of, you know, a shame that we couldn't be in the same room with each other and talk about it. But, you know, they talked a little bit about the, you know, kind of where the club has been over the last year. They talked a little bit about, you know, kind of the, you know, the struggles, the challenges that the club has in terms of financing and what's been going on with the coronavirus and the impact it's had on all of sports, but especially sports that really rely on butts in seats. I think this virus has had a bigger impact, as you can see, maybe with like minor league baseball and the other lower divisions of American soccer. So, you know, heck, not just American soccer, the low level of soccer in general. And then they talked, you know, I think the biggest things that a lot of the supporters were interested in is the future of the women's side. And so we talked a little bit about that. And again, we've heard what we've heard for the past several months. You'll hear more soon. And so we're hoping soon is soon. And, you know, there's some, you know, they talked a little bit about the transfer, because I think again, that is kind of very different for us to have transfer fees and all that stuff. So he talked, Jeremy talked a little bit about how that played out and the relationship between the player that left and you know, he was a player that never really intended to be in the third division. And so he wanted to play in the championship. And so he had a clause in his contract and, that if a championship club came calling and that kind of stuff. But what the point Jeremy was making was that when he left, he can sell the club, because the reason why he didn't want to come to the third division, because he didn't know what it was like. He expected it to be, you know, not really professional, that, you know, that the clubs weren't really taking care of their players. And this, you know, this may come from how some people talk about NISA. And so, you know, and he just didn't expect that, or didn't expect what he got. And what he got was, I think, what you and I know from the very get-go, Chattanooga has tried to act like a professional club. Mm-hmm. And we are, that has certainly not changed now that we actually have the official stamp of U.S. soccer approval to call ourselves a professional club. You know, that hasn't changed. And so, you know, he spent a lot of time talking about, you know, the fact that now he can go. And players talk and agents talk. And so when the next player that looks and says, well, I've got a choice between this club and CFC, that may make a big difference in what mm-hmm. other players and other agents were saying. So we talked a little bit about that, answered some supporter questions. And so it was neat. It was neat to hear not a lot of backroom stuff that I didn't know of, you know, already talking to the FO, you know, like we do to just to keep tabs on kind of what's going on with the club. But it was nice. I will say I think I tuned out a little bit. I was getting salty on Twitter about something. I don't remember what was going on at the same time. So I need to go back and listen to it to make sure that I didn't miss anything. But it was recorded and I can go back and listen to it. So I will. So yeah, it was neat. It was a neat experience to have an AGM for a club. So,
and kind of following that example, Detroit City recently actually offered equity and fan shares in their club in much the same WeFunder, using the same, it escapes me at the moment, the crowd sharing kind of equity raising.
Right.
The valuation of their club was, again, $10 million, mm-hmm. which placed what they could raise, I think, at $1 million.
And change
70,000 or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Now Detroit City, which it not unexpected, raised the maximum, but mm-hmm. did it much quicker than Chattanooga. Now obviously the metro area in Detroit's larger. Their footprint, I would just say, in lower league soccer in general is a little bit larger. It stretches over into Europe, and I'm not saying that Chattanooga doesn't, I know there was fans in Norway and Japan that bought into Chattanooga, but Detroit just, I think it's a different type of fan base. And so they sold theirs much, much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Iggy Pop, he bought a large amount of shares. But I think what was extremely fascinating to me was they actually splashed a lot of their financials up on their WeFunder and kind of explained where the money that they were raising was going to go, which primarily, I think, went into renovations to Keyworth, which was interesting because they don't own Keyworth. It would almost be like Chattanooga paying into Finley to renovate it, which is kind of interesting, a concept. I think they also they wanted to expand some of their marketing and some of their front office staff. What do you feel about Chattanooga offering fan shares? Did you buy any?
Did I buy Chattanooga or Detroit?
Detroit. That's what I meant.
Yeah, I did. I did. I mean, for one, well, the main reason I would say is that, we sold fan shares pretty soon after the events of 2018. I'll just say it that way.
He's talking about the Red Wolves. I can say their name. Jim has this hill that he dies on about it, but we're talking about Sean McDaniel and the the Voldemort, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. July 2018.
Yes.
So we sold them soon after that. And the fans of Detroit, which, I think there is we are linked in many ways with yes, Detroit City.
Absolutely.
And we are linked really as fan bases. We love to hate each other and we hate to love each other. So, mm-hmm. So they came to our, they had our back, and many of them, as they were wont to remind us afterwards, owned, owned shares of CFC, and they were the first to come out during that time with you may have seen a hashtag stand with Chatta. Mm-hmm. They started that and really perpetuated it, and they were beside us and stood with us. And so I think for one main reason, it was our duty to stand by them and support them as a club. Again, they do what we think clubs should do. And, I would even go so far as to say what they did for Keyworth is exactly what we say clubs should be. Mm-hmm. They gave to a stadium that was owned by, I believe the school system owns it.
Let me explain that real quick, Jim. In the state of Michigan, they have a law that it's a fascinating law, and I am baffled, truly baffled, why more states haven't adopted this law. But what you can do is you can actually pay, if you go way back into the You're Smarter Than Us archive, you can actually hear my conversation with Dion, and he kind of explains this, but you can basically invest, just an average Joe can invest once a city, school, a publicly owned infrastructure decides that it's going to renovate, you can actually invest into it a citizen mm-hmm. can, and you actually get a return on your mm-hmm. investment. So instead of taxes going up, instead of, you know, X, Y, and Z being collected to improve infrastructure, citizens actually pay, you know, they pitch their own money into this infrastructure improvement and then gets a dividend on the back end. I think I may have this number wrong, but I think Dion said it was something like 7 to 10% or something like that. So, you know, that's not unsubstantial, but you're also theoretically getting to, you know, whether it be a park or a stadium. This is, and I say this because Asheville is in a very, very similar situation. Our stadium, Memorial Stadium, is sitting up there on a hill. It's getting worse by the year. I haven't been up there in a couple weeks, but you know, because of the pandemic, it hasn't been taken care of real well. Now it's not getting played on as much either, but it's just aging. It's aging. It's 5 years away from being 100 years old. Now it's gone under some renovations, but I can't explain to you how much I wish I could pitch $2,500 into this renovation and then see on the back end, not only get a little bit of a return on that, but also see my community and specifically Asheville City benefit from that sort of investment. So yes, and so many Detroit City fans pitched into improving Keyworth, and they did. A quick little side note. There is a fan, a Northern Guard, who made jewelry on the back of mm-hmm. removed hardware from Keyworth. That's such a great idea. And if Memorial ever goes under, I'm definitely stealing that. She sold it and pitches it back into Northern Guard. It's just such an amazing idea. So yes, yeah, nonetheless, you know, Northern Guard, they're prickly on Twitter to say the least, but as a fan base, they do so much right.
Yeah, so I mean, so I felt, and I think I could speak for quite a few other CFC fans, we felt obligated to kind of come and support them as well. And so that's one reason why I did it. I love the idea of supporter ownership. That's another reason why I did it. And so now, when somebody, you know, when we beat them, I can just say, you know, we literally own you. So. It was a no-brainer for me, and it's something that, you know, we talked about with the DCFC FC guys, Sean Grogan and John Mazzina, about, like, you know, how I asked their take on is this something they see happening more often? Do they see more clubs doing this? And I have two minds. I'm of two minds. I think I do see it expanding. Eventually there will be other clubs that do it, but I just don't know how many clubs can do it. And the more that do it, the less novel it becomes, and fewer of the lower league, you know, hipster bros who want to invest just because they want to support lower league soccer, the fewer of them will do it. And so, I mean, like, you know, I could think of some clubs that would do it that I would pay into. You know, I think Oakland I would do. Maybe Asheville, if y'all wise up and discover the error of your ways, then maybe I would do it. But after that, I'm like, I don't really need to own shares of five different clubs. So, after a while, I wonder who will have the fan base to really, make it worthwhile. But there are some, and, you know, Forward could do it. You know, Madison could do it. But we'll see.
And let's be blunt when we talk about what you're actually paying for, because I think there's been a fascinating, the pandemic allowed a lot of lower league soccer fans the opportunity to have, I am such a big, because of my day job, I oftentimes go to businesses and I ask them to have very, very uncomfortable conversations. And at the end of those uncomfortable conversations, you know, I admit my biases, I get them to admit theirs, et cetera, et cetera. I always feel like I leave those conversations having a better understanding of their needs and wants. But I also feel like a weight is lifted off their shoulders because they, you know, thank you so much for, like, talking to me about these things that I don't necessarily know, or I didn't know if it was if it was okay to talk about. And I think lower league soccer fans, because of the pandemic, whether it be because of finances or you know, the nuts and bolts of things, I think we've started to ask ourselves some uncomfortable realities and conversations. And one of those has been about supporter ownerships. And Jacob Morrison put together a fantastic series of Zoom conversations, especially in the early days of the pandemic when everybody was sheltered in place, and kind of built this series of conversations from very, very, trying to think of the appropriate word that wouldn't sound insulting, but almost like membership-based community clubs. I'm thinking of Bear Fight and, you know, some of the smaller ones, and then built a little bit more and went kind of like DeKalb United, and then went a little bit bigger and eventually got to San Francisco City FC and Jeremy from Chattanooga. Jeremy actually was quickly, I didn't realize Tim Kelly was going to be on there. And I don't think Jeremy actually got a word in edgewise after Tim started speaking. But I think it really showed the spectrum of ownership. And I hesitate to call a lot of what is out there actual supporter ownership. And I'd say that even to the point where I don't 100% think that like what Chattanooga and Detroit is offering is 100% actual supporter ownership. And to be honest, I actually think what Chattanooga has is closer to it than what Detroit's offering. Can you kind of talk a little bit to that? Like what you spend $125, what do you get? I know with Chattanooga, you got a owner jersey and you got a, you know, a placard that basically says you're an owner, and Detroit offered something similar. But in Europe, actual supporter ownership, you kind of get to decide nuts and bolts. Detroit kind of offered ways to like memorialize club legends and like what jerseys look like. Now, Chattanooga, actually, you were just talking about the AGM. You guys actually have Claire, who was she on a 1 year? Is that going to be an annual vote that she has to deal with? 2 years?
I think it was 2 years.
Okay, but you guys actually have a representative that sits on the board. You know, can you juxtapose those two and kind of discuss like which you think is actually closer to ownership?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've gotten into several conversations about this, you know, the word ownership and what it means. And I put, you know, I look at equity ownership, and then there's control. And so I do think, some people, when they talk about ownership, they're really talking about control over a club. And I'm not necessarily talking about that when I talk about ownership. I'm truly just using it as an equity. You know, I don't have, and so what Detroit did is a little bit less control than CFC did. And what CFC did, even though there's an equity share, it's less control than San Francisco City. So I can get into a semantic argument with the folks from San Francisco City and say that's not equity ownership, it's not really ownership, it's membership. But there's a control element that I think is really intriguing about their model that we don't have. I mean, so, but if you were to look at CFC and DCFC side by side, the real difference is the supporter owners have a vote in a board member. We choose a board member that represents the supporters. And so for these 2 years, Claire goes and she represents all of the supporter owners around the world. And Detroit City chose not to have a supporter owner board member. And so, you know, they own equity, but they have even less control over, and, you know, and how much control do we really have? It's one vote out of 10 or 11 board members, but it's still some. And so that's the difference between what CFC did and DCFC did. But if you look at a membership, you know, something like what San Francisco did, you know, they have lifetime members who pay once and don't have to pay anything else. And they select a board member who, and I think there are only three members of their board. And they cannot make major decisions without a unanimous agreement among those three. So they have, the fans have real power over a third of their board. And so that's control. I mean, there's a lot of control there. And so that's how I choose to look at it. There's a difference between ownership and control of the club. We don't have, you know, we're not voting on jerseys like you might see with Minneapolis City. We don't, you know, we're not voting on scarves like other clubs are. You know, so we're voting on a board member who then could go and voice, has a voice for the supporters in the boardroom.
Yeah. Part of what, I think San Francisco, if you're going to make a more like meta comparison to something that somebody might be more familiar with, it's the 50+1 model that you see in Germany oftentimes, yeah, which is what that actually is. Now, the one thing I do want to say before we move on with our Nisa conversation, out of those Jacob Morrison conversations that we had was, oh goodness gracious, Oakland County, up in Michigan. They mm-hmm. are a club that I think was NPSL and then eventually yep. went League Two. Mm-hmm. And to be perfectly blunt, I don't think what they did well. But what they put out there was kind of like what Exeter City in England did, which is a fan trust. And this is not an ownership stake, but what it does is it allows fans to finance into a trust. And what Oakland did was they actually took their trust and then spent it. But I do think there is an opportunity in U.S. sports, you know, away from it, almost as a intermediate step between nothing and what Chattanooga or San Francisco has done. Because I don't know, because of PLS, that what San Francisco has done can actually be done professionally. But I think mm-hmm. Chattanooga has the best version of it thus far. What a fan trust could theoretically allow fans to do, though, is to pitch into something that money can then be dividends or interest or something can be pulled out of at a certain number each year and then reinvested back into the club, whether it be 10,000, 15,000, 20,000. And I know, you know, when you're talking about pro sports, that number sounds very small. But if you're using it almost like what I would picture Asheville using it for, you could use it to pay for a coach. You could use it to pay something for the academy, which our academy is free to play. So it's breaking that cycle of pay to play. Something like that, I think, is a good middle step. And it was really interesting to hear Oakland's owner talk about it, but then kind of hear, you know, the way that they used it, it was almost used as like a marketing ploy. Hey, come join our, you know, our supporters group, buy into us. We're going to spend whatever, you know, $5,000 they raised or something like that. I think with a more built out system, I think there's more opportunity there.
Yeah. And so, there's a little bit of that in what CFC and DCFC did too. You know, mm-hmm, I mean, there's a little mm-hmm. bit of the marketing ploy. You know, I have a nice certificate and, you know, I have other things that you know, the bat, a little pin, and they didn't give us the jersey. We had an opportunity to buy an owner's jersey.
Oh, but, okay.
You know, but so did everybody else. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, you know, so they did give us some stuff there, you know, and I think one of the neat things I think Detroit learned is they built more levels into their.
Yes. The 50K level was mouth-watering. If I had more faith, if I had lived in Detroit and had more faith in just NISA kind of, you know, existing again within 10 years, I don't know if anything that exists now is going to exist, but the benefits and rewards that came with the 50K.
Yeah, but they even go down to the lower levels. Oh, they encourage you to buy 2 shares, and that's where they mm-hmm. gave you the stuff. That mm-hmm. doubles the amount of, because, you know, a lot of people just bought 1 share of CFC because they mm-hmm. gave them the little bells and whistles. But to get the little bells and whistles, you bought 2 shares of that, which doubles the initial investment, which I think created, I mean, I think there were a number of reasons why they raised as much as, I mean, they have a rabid fan base. They are right now doing things just really, really well. They're in a, they're, I mean, they're, I mean, they're in Detroit. They're 10 times the size Chattanooga is.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they're just doing things well. But they also, I think, learned some things from what we did and built in different intermediate levels that allow people to give a couple more dollars and get some stuff. I mean, heck, it worked on me, Tim. I didn't buy just one. I bought two so I could get the scarf.
So you
get
the scarf. I knew you were going to say that.
So that's how, I mean, hey, I'm a sucker. Yeah, I'm a sucker for a scarf. So, so it worked on me and I bought two shares. So, I mean, I think they learned some things from us and did a really good job. And I don't think it was a surprise to anybody that they kind of sold out their allotment. Even I was a little surprised at how quickly it went, but I wasn't terribly surprised. And so it was, you know, kudos to them. They did a really good job. And so now I own two professional clubs.
And to be clear, neither Chattanooga nor Detroit did this on a lark. Chattanooga had intended to do it for a while, apparently, which I think as a role model and forerunner of independent amateur soccer in this country made sense for them. But what expedited that entire process was the Red Wolves coming to town.
Absolutely.
You know, and it was in direct response to that. Detroit, again, if you hear any podcast with Sean Mann or an interview, he again says, you know, we always wanted to do this. We, had talked to Chattanooga when they did it and learned from them. But he's also very honest that it's because of the pandemic that kind of forced their hand to do this. So I think that's also a key component to any club in the future actually offering this. And again, it's a law that was actually put in place, I think, in 2016. I think we all know my personal beliefs about our current president, but it was something that he and his administration put in. Not specifically to benefit lower league soccer, but we were able to take advantage of it. Now there's also lower, you know, the opportunity zones and other things that lower league soccer has been able to take advantage of, which I think is fascinating, but nonetheless, putting that to the side. I hope, like you were saying though, that Oakland or some of these other clubs don't do it just to do it, but, you know, use it as that sort of break, you know, in case of emergency, break glass, because I think when you have something, a project, an improvement, a renovation, that money's going to be earmarked for, I think there's going to be more proof in the pudding, more tangible improvements that you can directly say, this is because we did this. I think if you do it just to generally fundraise and then pay a coach or, you know, improve your wage bill or something like that, it's going to water down exactly what you're saying. So, but, you know, even in your last podcast, you and the guys from the podcast up north talked about how there isn't a deep bench of clubs that could potentially do this. So I think it should almost kind of self-regulate itself. So
yeah,
that's Chattanooga, that's Detroit. I'm going to kind of actually glaze over the New York Cosmos. This continues to be a club with a very rich history in this country. I think everybody knows who the Cosmos are. I think everybody knows what their crest looks like. I am willing to bet if you ask 9 out of 10, or if you were to ask 10 lower league fans, I don't know that 9 out of 10 of them could even tell you where they're currently playing, which is on Long Island, unfortunately. Yeah. I think most may even remember their NASL days from, somewhere in Brooklyn or something like that. They continue to be a club that has a very, very, very rich owner who is willing to invest in them, but needs to position them to be worthy of an investment. You know, he recently bought a Serie A team that's doing, not poorly, but it offers that pro rel itch that he literally sued the federation to try to scratch.
Yep.
The Cosmos are the Cosmos are the Cosmos. I respect their fans. I hate what's happening to them, but I also don't think they even can be compared to Chattanooga and Detroit right now in terms of prestige and what they're doing for the lower leagues. Moving on from there, you have the Michigan Stars. Jim, tell me about the Stars. Tell anybody listening to this podcast about the Stars.
Tell about the Stars. Well, I'm not really sure where to. I mean, it really just this. It starts and ends with George. How do you pronounce his name? Yukai, something like that.
Yukai,
something like that. So he bought the club, and you know, his son plays for them, and you know, at least in the NPSL iteration of it, it was really just a kind of a plaything for this is. Hey, I don't have any Stars fan friends. I'm not sure I really could, but it it was just kind of their plaything to give Steven and I can't remember the other brother's name a chance to play soccer, and so they run a company, HTC I think it's called, and you know they're well funded as long as the Suns are playing, I think, and. So now they joined NISA because I think the kids wanted to be professional soccer players. I don't know much beyond that what interest the owner has in it. They bought some new players. They are much better than they were in the NPSL. I think they are. And, I mean, well, one reason is they beat us last week. So, but they are what they are. And I don't know that they will ever be much more than they are now. I would like to see them, I have nothing against them. I don't have nearly the attitude towards them that, that's other fans that DCFC fans have about them. You know, they don't do what I think we think of as what clubs should do. They're not really engaged in their mm-hmm. community. They don't really connect with Pontiac. They are just a soccer team that plays soccer, and I don't really know that they do much else. And so, if that changed, if they kind of shifted their focus to be more community oriented and cared about it, cared about being a club more than just a team that the kids can play on, then I'm here for it. But right now they're a filler, in my opinion. They're there to make the PLS. We need 8 teams. Hey, there's the Stars. We'll put them in there. And I hope they become more. But if they don't, we need to build. NISA needs to build with other clubs and they can be there as long as they want to be there.
And part of what I think makes the Stars interesting, I guess the only thing that makes them interesting to me, is that they actually are located in Detroit. So again, to juxtapose options in the future, the lower league sandbox that I think Asheville City has eyes on eventually. Part of what USL does is they sell, when you become a USL franchise, you buy into territory rights. Well, you don't buy into them, you purchase a territory right. And mm-hmm. this, is the exact same as Major League Baseball, basketball, NFL, et cetera, et cetera. Certain markets allow you to have more than one team, New York Jets, New York Giants, Oakland A's, San Francisco Giants, things of that nature. But at a lower league soccer level, and I would assume this also exists at the MLS level, though, I don't have friends who have found franchise agreements for MLS, but I am speaking to one who has found USL franchise agreements. you buy into this agreement and then you get a bubble. Now, even NPSL actually had this, and they've canceled expansion plans for teams that were encroaching, because obviously the concept of lower league soccer isn't infinite, and there's only so much entertainment dollars out there, and a fan who may be sitting on a border and is, 15 miles from one club, if you put him 15 miles from another club, now you're splitting his loyalties and, again, his dollars. So USL has, their bubbles are very defined, whether it be 45, 90 miles, something to that effect. There's actually language in some of your, it's not in your PLS, but there's something about that, almost says, like, if you're going to become a PLS franchised club in USL, you get a certain amount, a certain perimeter, a certain geographical bubble that other teams can't encroach upon. Now, you can allow them to, and sometimes that, you know, actually is to your advantage, you know, to create a rivalry or something. Part of what NISA is pitching as a attraction to them, part of what they're saying is no, territory rights actually are a detriment to the growth of soccer. Look at Europe. Now, I'll talk about this in a second because I think they have an issue with this sales pitch, but they're saying, look at Europe, look at, you know, all these successful federations across the globe that lean into the concept of derbies, that lean into the concept of if a community is a certain size, it can actually house more than one club, because that creates a natural east side, west side. It creates a natural north south sort of friction that can only, you know, make things better and bigger. And so the Michigan Stars actually are housed in Pontiac, which is, you know, a suburb of Detroit proper. And so Detroit City and the Michigan Stars are actually in the same city. And that was the first of, I guess only now two or three. I guess out west they had a derby, but it's again, out west is kind of funky right now.
Yeah.
But NISA truly believes in the power of the derby. And to speak about the fifth participant in the East NISA right now, we have New Amsterdam. Jim, I'm going to forbid you to talk about their crest.
I know,
but I'm going to forbid you. Okay. Because, you know, Jim literally broke it down to like pixels of one soccer ball in their crest being off center, blah, blah, blah. But they've come out with some pretty powerful branding, which hasn't, you know, between Stump Town and Michigan Stars, it hasn't been really the norm for NISA, but it looks good. It looks sharp. It looks professional. It's not it's not the roundel with the gothic typeface, and I say that as a National City fan, but it is just something unique, and it leans very much into the history of New York City. They're going to play up in the Bronx, I think at Fordham. Is that correct?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. And they I'm not going to lie, they're populating their roster with an interesting collection of players. A lot of them, again, it's a pro team, D3, but a lot of their players actually also work for the company that the owner owns. So it's this weird kind of mix mash of, I don't know. There's not really rules about how NISA clubs can pay their players. So I don't really understand the need to like pay them on two fronts, blah, 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 blah. But they came out and they made quite the splash recently. They hired Eric Winalda, former U.S. men's national team player, also former Atlanta Silverbacks coach, who coached them onto a deep U.S. Open Cup run a couple years ago. He recently was coaching the Las Vegas Lights in USL Championship. You know, that's probably the largest profiled coach in NISA at the present moment. What were your first impressions of New Amsterdam?
They were, you know, they're a work in progress. They're a very, very rough work in progress. They played some friendlies early on against some, you know, Cosmopolitan League teams. Yeah. and lost. I'm one who will constantly say I do not put much, if anything, in friendlies, whether positive or negative. So I'm not gonna poke at them for losing those, because I don't know who played. I don't know what the coach was trying to do with the games. You just never know. It's a friendly, so it doesn't look good, no matter what you say, to lose to a team like that when you're trying to be a Division III professional team. So, but then they came out and drew with the Cosmos, which I think raised my eyebrows until the Cosmos then came out later on and drew with the Bobcats. But I don't know. They're a work in progress, is that, and I think that was what we all thought they would be. Like you said, their roster is a little strange. The owner plays keeper, and has played in matches. So,
I mean, he's about like 4 inches shorter than me, but weighs the same amount as me.
Yeah, he's he's built. So they're a work in progress. I think they did do nicely with their branding, minus one thing that you told me I can't talk about. So, but outside of that, I do like it. It's a little different. Hopefully they're going to lean into the orange, which I think will be cool for the Dutch. You know, the mm-hmm. Dutch history of the New York area. So I think that's cool. The other parts of the kit, it's really black and white. Looks a lot like every kit in the West does. So, hopefully they'll get more, adventurous with their design in the coming years. But can I go back to the conversation about territorial rights real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I think the pitch is, I hear a lot of people talk about, well, look at what happens in Liverpool when you've got Liverpool and Everton with like 2 miles apart. Look at North London.
Not even 2 miles.
Yeah, I know. Like a stone's throw. And look at North London there's not a lot of distance between Arsenal and Tottenham. And look at those. So that's fine. That's a decent way of looking at it. What territorial rights mean for me is it's picking and choosing who can play and who can be a part of the group. And that's the part I have a big problem with. Now, listen, sometimes you go in and you get the right mix and you have a forward Madison, right? And so Madison, that club is doing things really well. And you can't see somebody else coming in and doing things better than them, right? I mean, I wouldn't see, it would take a lot for another club to come into Madison and do things better than forward Madison is doing, right? But in another world, if the Red Wolves came first, and I said their name, I'm sorry, we do things differently and better than they do. But in that world, we can't exist. And so that is just ridiculous in my mind. You pick and choose. So, hey, if you trust USL to pick the right team to have the right club for your community, that's fine. But they don't always do that. And there's some guys in Lansing that understand that. Mm-hmm. And there's some people in Tucson that I think are understanding that. And there's some people in Fresno that are wondering where their club went. And so, why, if that team in Fresno, if there are supporters there that want a club, why do they have to rely on that dude to do it? Why can't somebody else come in and say, we're going to do it, we're going to do it better? In that environment, you can't do it. The first one to the market wins, and that is crap. That is sheer, utter BS. And so that, more than what's going on in Europe, is where I have a real problem with territorial rights. And to be honest, the only reason why territorial rights exist is because that's what gives that franchise value. So because you can shut out anybody else, you don't have competition. And that sucks.
Now, to be 100% fair, because again, I actually completely 100% agree with you, but this is not necessarily a USL issue as much. Let me actually rephrase that, because that's not correct. It's not a USL directive. It is what the USSF is allowing to occur. Because the USSF has not set up a fully developed pyramid that encourages promotion and relegation. It doesn't encourage D4, D3. You know, a D3 until 2 years ago didn't exist.
Yeah,
no. And until, goodness gracious, 10 years ago, the D2 was roughshod and haphazard and would kind of start and stop and start and stop. And, Nike of all companies owned the mm-hmm. D. I mean, think about that. Mm-hmm. Nike owned the D2 and saw such little value in it that they sold it for pennies on the dollar, basically. Mm-hmm. And now a real estate investment firm in Alpharetta, Georgia is the owner of basically the best organized D2 league in America.
In the world.
Well, thank you, Jake Edwards. So my point being is, you know, every other, well, maybe not every other country, but most well-organized federations across the globe, you know, see the value in having a competitive, integrated pyramid that allows different clubs. So, and basically what I'm trying to describe is in Chattanooga, there theoretically should be room for the Red Wolves. There should be room for CFC, but what it should allow for is two different approaches. It should allow for the Michigan Stars and it should allow for Detroit City, but theoretically on the back of, maybe I'm being romantic here, but on the back of the community rallying around CFC and Detroit City, it should, unless an owner comes in and just, you know, drops a lot of money because the FFP doesn't actually mean anything, it should propel those teams forward. And you could end up in a situation where if a pyramid was more built out, that you had Detroit City and Chattanooga in a D2 situation, and you would have the Red Wolves with their 250 fans and the Stars with their 125 fans in D4. But because we're not allowed that kind of vertical up and down, that vertical integration of sporting merit, what you are unfortunately left with is just what you described, that first to the market, that, boys club of we have bought into this. Now, because we are, you know, kind of chatting on an Asheville City podcast, I do want to say Asheville City has moved into this, you know, closed system of USL, and there's going to be pluses and minuses of it. And in their statement, when they moved to League Two, they did state their intent to eventually move to League One. There's nothing written in stone. There's flexibility. I think, again, this was a move that Asheville made because at the moment where they were, which was the NPSL, they couldn't move to NISA anytime soon. I don't know if they held conversations with NISA or not, but NISA doesn't have an amateur side. The NPSL is this dumpster. There's footage somewhere. I don't know if it's a meme or a GIF or something of a dumpster that's on fire floating down a river. And that's basically what the NPSL is at this point. They have given up any advantage they had in the amateur game. They have, under their current leadership, chosen to, and I'll just continue to beat this drum, they have chosen to be the best at nothing and mediocre at everything. I don't know how else to describe them. They are chasing things that bear no benefit to them. And I think they have one competent, maybe a pair of competent people on their national board. And other than that, they're just being led by fools, basically. So I think Asheville read the writing on the wall and they got out of that bad situation. I don't know. I would hope that they're not completely wedded to USL, but I also, at the same time, to defend USL in somewhat, I think USL is making moves, whether it be with the women's game, whether it be with the concept of Pro Rel, again, open system and a closed system. I do think they're making advancement that a lot, I actually would venture to say the vast majority of lower league fans would like to see implemented. So
yeah, but I think it's shadow puppets. I mean, I do. There's just so much wrong with, I could go on for a long time about the problems I have with the system. I mean, there's nothing stopping them. I mean, they eat their own. I mean, there's nothing stopping them from going to whoever the richest person is in Asheville. I don't know. Biltmore, something with Biltmore. I don't know. They go to him and say, and all of a sudden he wants a soccer team. They could plop a League One team down there and Asheville's dead. So Asheville City's dead. I mean, that's exactly what happened to Lansing United. You can't convince me. Well, I mean, you can convince me that that's going to be the winner of the soccer wars. That's, yeah, sure. They might be that. But that, well, but
look at exactly what just happened in St. Louis FC. Even USL is subject to cannibalism of the federation at the present moment. Which
I know.
To explain again, maybe not everybody knows, but basically what just happened, USL. The St. Louis team in USL Championship, who by every account has had this passionate, almost the Northern Guard Chattahooligans of the USL, a very well known supporters group, the St. Hooligans, they're so successful. I don't think they've ever won the USL Championship, but they were so well known, Chattanooga FC just got their new GM basically from them. But they won, and had been under this, to be perfectly honest, I want to be careful here because one of our Asheville City owners actually was part of the MLS for the Lou or whatever the hashtag was. She's from St. Louis and, actually helped that process for them to obtain an MLS. But Dan, am I getting the name right? Dan Floyd, Dan Flynn worked with U.S. Soccer in a very high position, actually resigned and then represented St. Louis in two, U.S. Soccer to obtain this MLS spot, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Nonetheless, they also have, I don't care what anybody says, that crest is hideous. It's terrible. They could have done so much better. I also don't think they stole it from Minneapolis.
Up the thieves. Up the thieves.
No, that's so silly.
Nonetheless,
but the USL Championship team had in their front office members who eventually are going to become part of the MLS front office. And maybe they're part of the ownership group, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, as soon as they became an MLS team, they released their championship team. So it's almost this, like, again, bastardized version of promotion. But what they're doing is they're shuttering their USL championship team. So this, I know exactly why. I'm now at this point kind of explaining to the listeners, but this fantastic supporters group and club that has existed in St. Louis is now disbanding because they are a 501c3 as an organization, and MLS won't allow a nonprofit into their. It's actually, I recently learned, this is a different conversation, Jim, but now I'm just kind of narrating. MLS is actually not fully a single entity, but we'll chat about that sometime.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, they can't allow a nonprofit in. So basically, they have to disband. And now, and they're not starting for another year or two. So now these fans are going to be left without a soccer team for a couple of years.
Well, there's that. But, you can't take the USL team to MLS because he would owe millions of dollars to USL. Oh,
yes, exactly.
So he's killing.
What is it? Seven
million, I think.
No, it's 7%. 7%.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. 7%. That's right.
Yeah.
So I mean, he's killing the club in part to save himself millions of dollars. So hey, good for him, I guess. But I wouldn't really. I mean, again, hey, they've got their thing in St. Louis. I don't. You support how you support. I don't want to really disparage them at all. They've supported other clubs in St. Louis. It's kind of their part of their thing to support the highest level of soccer in St. Louis. And so that's why they've been with the championship. Okay, whatever. But and then some of them probably won't go on to support the MLS. I just can't do that. I mean,
of course.
Am I better than anybody else? No, that's just not how I support. The owner came to them and said, hey, will you support me in my new venture? And he's killing the club to save himself money. And I just, I'm not a Tim Kelly fan. I mean, I like Tim, but I'm not a Tim Kelly fan. I'm a Jeremy fan. I like Jeremy. I'm a CFC fan. And the people who own the club right now, they are stewards of the club. The club is not stewards of them. They are not the thing. And so it just bothers me. And see, so you wanted spicy. You wanted salty, Jim. You thought you'd get
there. Morton's is finally getting their advertising dollars.
Yeah, you thought you'd get it because we lost. But, I mean, you know.
Well, I'm not going to lie. As soon as you guys beat Detroit, visit Utah, and the Bonneville Salt Flats actually backed out of their advertisement. So I'm a little disappointed. I literally had a whole, like, you know, thing that they submitted. So I'm a bit disappointed. But
I'm sorry.
It's all right. So last thing, let's chat. Mm-hmm. NISA continues to expand. I kind of alluded it earlier. I've heard to kind of fully, you know, my Asheville listeners probably don't actually understand the depths of my lower league soccer nerddom. They see me at the bar and I chat with them about Arsenal and my hatred of Chelsea and Tottenham. And, mm-hmm. you know, they understand my like top level of soccer fandom. They don't really see me sitting on like NISA threads at 2:30 in the mornings, talking to Taco Man 86X and, you know, you know, my other NISA friends. But I do have these contacts, these shady corners of lower league soccer social media that I kind of dwell in and peddle in. And I have heard from several different places, and none of which I think I'm at liberty to talk about because some of it offends NDAs and different things of that nature. But NISA's expansion plan, NISA's expansion pitch continues to suffer, especially compared to USLs, to an American fan base, to an American ownership base, to be perfectly blunt, an American commercial sponsorship base. NISA's sales pitch, which again, to frame, is more or less on the back of, we have no territory rights, we have no expansion fees. So instead of spending $2 million to basically just come under our central office, pay, I think it's like $150,000, and then pay $250,000 a year. And all that money that you can save, you can pitch forwards into your roster, into your coaching and things of that nature. Now, we're not going to do your social media for you, clearly. we're not going to do X, Y, and Z for you. That's on you. But you can enter into our system and compete against the Cosmos, Detroit City, Chattanooga, et cetera, et cetera. As opposed to USL, which says we have this pretty package for you, pay $2 million, come into under our umbrella, pay, I have no idea what their yearly fees are. I'm sure it's $75,000, $100,000 a year. But we will, you know, make you some social media templates. We'll pitch you. We'll, you know, splash this on you. We'll splash that on you. Now, at the current moment, USL sales pitch plays extremely well to Chamber of Commerce's. When the Greenville Triumph came into town, over and over, you heard about how, yes, there was this groundswell, especially from the American Outlaws in the Greenville area of, you know, please bring a professional team, please bring a professional team. But when you actually heard of who they were talking to, the owners, the Edwards, and the Irwins, they were talking to the Chamber of Commerce. They were talking, they were trying to explain how a minor league soccer team in their city would benefit corporations. They would benefit businesses. When you hear Omaha, they went directly to the Chamber of Commerce. This is who you have to find contacts with, and you have to find kind of simpatico philosophies with within your cities if you're going to get that buy-in. And NISA's sales pitch is not resonating. It's just not. The concept of no expansion fee, I just think it's a matter of fact that especially at the lower league soccer level, people would rather pay to have this sort of stuff prepackaged than to have to pay to do it themselves. I think that's silly. I think a lot of people think that's silly. It's just, it is what it is. Moreover, I think the idea of territory rights is more attractive to a lot of owners, a lot of people who are going to, and of course, but I guess what I mean is if somebody actually reaches and meets the PLS standards, I think you're going to find that sort of cutthroat business thought of I would rather have these territory rights. So yes. Now what NISA is doing is NISA, I think, is finding the inefficiencies at the moment that USL has not quite been able to touch. And the club that recently has announced that they actually are applying for sanctioning with NISA is the Maryland Bobcats. The Maryland Bobcats very recently were known as world-class premier.
Elite, world-class premier.
Okay. Good God.
It's even worse.
They were a UPSL, which I guess is almost a de facto like fifth division in the country. It's kind of an amateur level. We actually have between North and South Carolina probably close to a dozen UPSL teams, and probably most people don't even know they exist because these are your clubs that are kind of are popular. The rosters are populated by 9-to-5ers and ham and eggers and, you know, people who have day jobs and do this for fun, but compete in, you know, very competitive adult amateur leagues, oftentimes in metropolitan areas where it's almost a step up above your like Asheville amateur adult league. It's just one step above that, but not quite at your summer league level. But I would imagine a lot of players. You actually see some NPSL teams have a partnership. Tulsa is a good example, NPSL, but then they also have a UPSL team.
Mm-hmm.
So world-class premier elite moves into NPSL, which is a nominal step up. They rebrand as the Maryland Bobcats. I actually think it's fairly slick, Brandon. It's nothing special, but I mean, it's a step up from what they had been doing. And then very quickly, after 1 year, they have a very successful year in the NPSL. And now they state their intent to go NISA. And they're actually going to apply. Now, again, they actually start playing a couple NISA teams in what is the Independent Cup, and they do extremely well against these teams. Do you think this sort of NPSL, UPSL graduate is what NISA is going to depend on in the future? Or do you think there's going to be almost like spontaneous clubs that pop up will populate?
The little bit that I've talked to, there's a couple of people within NISA that I kind of talked to just to kind of get a sense of what's really going on. And so there's a mix. I mean, I think a lot of people thought that Maryland might do this. And then when they were in the Independent Cup, I think more people thought, okay, they're making a move. And you know, then they announced that there was going to be a press conference and everybody knew what that was going to be. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a handful of NPSL teams that might do that, that might make a jump. But I'm starting to really wonder and starting to sense that there's a real fray, and this may be to some folks out there may be like, well, yeah, Jim, everybody knows this, but there's a real fray between NPSL and NISA. And I think UPSL right now is more and UPSL and the of course you've got the great the GCPL Gulf Coast Premier, so those they're developing relationships with the regional amateur leagues too, and so I think you're going to see more of those types of clubs give it a go, and less and fewer NPSL teams. There are a couple, I think, that people can point to in the NPSL that might eventually, we were going to play a couple of them. ECFC was this fall or this summer before stuff happened. But again, I've also heard that there are some groups, there are some New Amsterdams, for lack of a better way of saying, that there are groups out there who want to do things they don't exist currently as a club. And so, you know, everybody says we're looking at 40 markets or whatever. So, you know, that's what I constantly hear, is that there are several groups that are in advanced talks, whatever the heck that means, with Nisa. And I would hope that that means that we might see some more movement by the end of the year. But I don't know. But I think it's a mixture, Tim, of both UPSL teams that exist and some new markets or some new clubs that are going to be created, kind of like you saw with New Amsterdam and whatever it is the Teamsters are.
And I used to have, oh my God, I forgot all about the Discovery Channel Starlings that are the New Jersey Teamsters. Guys, I'm not even going to go down that path. That's going to be a story for another day. Please check them out if you haven't heard about them yet. But I do want to say, just to kind of put a bow on this conversation, that if I have self-reflected on nothing else, I think my preconceived biases and notions about what would make a good or what characteristics a club would have to show to make a good positive leap forward into going from an amateur club to a professional club, I think I would have been misconstrued the evidence before me, because I would have thought that several of the clubs that have moved forwards, whether they be the Cal Strikers or Oakland, I think always had pro written all over them. But, I never would have thought the Stars would have, but I didn't know enough about them. So I don't know that what I know of clubs, the Bobcats, I wouldn't have picked the Bobcats. So I don't necessarily know that the summer clubs that succeed in the NPSL and even League Two are always going to be the clubs that make the most sense to go pro. I actually think the characteristics of a sustainable, successful UPSL team, which again is a nominal D5 team in this country, but they play year round.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't draw a lot of fans. They may draw 600 fans. They may draw 700 fans. The PLS, though, for D3 is only a stadium that holds 1,000 fans. Yeah. Now, the owner worth and stuff along those lines, those standards are kind of sketchy. But at the same time, you see a lot of clubs around this country who are owned by, successful car salesmen. They are owned by a successful X, Y, and Z. And what they do is they own a club because that's what their hobby is. They don't own a motorcycle. They don't own three vacation homes. What they do is they own a small amateur soccer team, and they meet those standards and theoretically can pitch that forward. They can, leverage that forwards into a professional soccer team. Don't get it mixed up, guys. Minor league baseball players don't get paid a lot. You're looking at less than $500, $600 a month. Amateur or minor league soccer players oftentimes don't get paid a lot at all. There were some horror stories coming out of Hartford last year. By all accounts, CFC does amazingly right by their players, and I would expect nothing less. Some of the bigger teams do extremely well, of course, but it doesn't cost a lot to run a third division soccer team in this country at the moment. I hope that changes one day. So again, my preconceived notions against UPSL, and, I don't care how well the best UPSL team, blah, 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 blah. I actually think that's not the correct way to look at it. And I would not be shocked if you see more and more UPSL teams in the future, who UPSL as a league actually recently got bought out. And I wouldn't be surprised if they don't undergo a certain sort of evolution. And again, because NPSL is a dumpster fire floating down a river that can't get out of its own way, and is doing ridiculous stuff, like instead of improving their stature as a summer league, they're instituting stuff like U19 Academy. I don't understand what they're doing. So UPSL, I would not be shocked if they kind of figure out themselves. They've already got Pro Rel figured out. They've got other things figured out. So Jim, we've been chatting for a while. Let's wrap this up. I appreciate you, sir. Let's do this again soon. Maybe, let's touch base in the winter and see where Nice is at, see where these expansion clubs are at. Literally right before we started to record, there was a fairly well-known lower league soccer journalist who, I think just off the cuff, stated his personal opinion that Nice is failing. So long may he be wrong, and let's chat soon and talk about how well CFC is doing.
I appreciate it. Absolutely.
I guess that's why they call us the Blues. Time on our hands could be time spent with brews. Drinking like tourists, yelling like drunkards, scoring some sunners.
Been listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast. Shoot us an email at youresmarterthanus@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @YOURE_smarter.